You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Markus Hippi. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Germany has decided to take up the job of training the Malian army in putting up against the Islamist rebels. Monocle's defense correspondent tells us what Germany has to offer and if that is going to be what the Malian forces really need. London tops the ranking list on the most expensive office spaces, prices being more than double of the ones in Paris and New York. It's worthwhile to ask what you actually get for the money in the English capital and if it's worth it. Tech expert David Phelan pops in studio and gives Monocle the first sneak peek at the only HTC One in town.
It's a very beautiful phone, I think. It's not out till next month. That's the only phone outside of HTC at this moment.
I also speak to Brazilian director Marcelo Galvao, who is on the way of becoming one of the most influential filmmakers in South America. His latest film on teens with Down syndrome has already won the prize of the best film in Brazil.
It's a light movie, it's not like a drama, not talking about disabilities, but talking about life, dreams.
All that plus we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, let's catch up on the news headlines with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Prosecutors have directly challenged two of Oscar Pistorius's claims about the night he shot and killed his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp. Investigating officer Hilton Wurters told the Pistorius bail hearing in Pretoria a witness saw lights on after the shooting. Despite claims, the athlete thought there was an intruder in his home and he was too frightened to switch on the light. A statement on behalf of the 26-year-old Paralympian, read out in court, also said he was not wearing his prosthetic legs at the time and he felt vulnerable. But Mr. Buerta said the trajectory of the shots fired through the bathroom door was downward, suggesting he was firing from a standing position at a height where he must have been wearing the limbs. The case has gripped South Africa for the last 2 days. These Pretoria residents say Oscar Pistorius has to deal with what he's done.
It clearly shows that he had problems himself, especially personally.
I think about all the children who looked up to him and saw him as a role model. So it's very difficult for me to accept this, but I hope that justice will be served in court.
It was a blunt game that he did, and according to me, I doubt if I want him to be out of the prison.
David Cameron has become the first serving British Prime Minister to pay his respects at the scene of the notorious Amritsar massacre in India. Mr. Cameron, who's on a 3-day trade trip to the country, described the massacre in 1919 as a deeply shameful event. Police in Athens have fired tear gas on demonstrators taking part in the latest protest against government austerity measures. Riot police responded after hooded youths threw stones and bottles at them. The country is being brought to a standstill by a 24-hour general strike. Europe's horsemeat scandal has spread to Asia, where an imported lasagna brand has been taken off the shelves in Hong Kong. Food and environmental hygiene officials have ordered Park and Shop, one of the biggest supermarket chains on the island, to remove the product amid fears it may be adulterated with horsemeat that's not been tested for veterinary drugs. The chain has about 280 stores in Hong Kong and the neighbouring gaming hub of Macau. Former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. has pleaded guilty to misusing around $750,000 US dollars of campaign money. Mr. Jackson, who's the son of the civil rights leader, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, wept as he entered the plea at court in Washington, D.C. He faces up to 5 years in prison. Prosecutors say the 47-year-old, who's been treated for bipolar disorder, used the funds for personal expenses and failed to report gifts. The Vatican says Pope Benedict may change church rules governing the conclave, the event where cardinals from around the world will meet next month to secretly elect his successor. A spokesman says Benedict is studying the possibility of making changes to two laws established by his predecessor, Pope John Paul, before he abdicates on February the 28th. The changes may affect the timing of the start of the election process. Reuters Vatican correspondent Philip Pollella says the conclave could be held as early as March the 10th.
It's a very controversial point that this is, because basically some people say that a conclave that begins earlier will favor the cardinals who reside in Rome all the time, that they already know each other, and that they will also have undue influence on cardinals who live outside Rome, who would be coming to Rome and will seek their counsel.
Silvio Berlusconi has infuriated his political rivals by sending letters to millions of Italians promising to reimburse tax they paid in 2012. In a final drive for votes before this weekend's election, he's promised to repay an unpopular property tax, either by bank transfer or over the counter at post offices. Mr. Berlusconi has repeatedly promised to repay the tax, but polls show 51% of Italians don't believe him, and only 15% find the promise credible. Meanwhile, an Italian anti-corruption party that threatened to divert votes away from Silvio Berlusconi's centre-right party has been thrown into disarray after its leader resigned. Oscar Giannino, the leader of the pro-business Stop the Decline party, has resigned after admitting he'd claimed false academic credentials. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Bill, and we will get the next news headlines in 24 minutes. 18.06 in London, 13.06 in New York City. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. You are listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. And today we start with the situation in Mali and the role Germans are going to play in it. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel's cabinet has decided that Bundeswehr is to provide training and offer its expertise for the Malian army, busy fighting against the Islamic insurgents. Is this going to make a huge difference in Mali and what it actually is that the Malian military forces need the most? Joining us on the line from Nairobi is our correspondent, Tristan McConnell. Tristan, first of all, can you tell us what exactly it is that these German military experts are going to do in Mali?
Well, Germany's government has said that they're going to send a total of 330 soldiers to Mali. A little over half of these are going to be part of a European Union training mission, which was approved on Monday this week. That's a 500-member European training force who are going to work to try to really overhaul the Malian army. So this is going to involve, you know, training them in basic military tactics, trying to essentially professionalize an army that has really been woeful over recent years, and to an extent contributed a great degree to the problems that Mali is now facing. If you remember, about a year ago now, it was a coup by officers, junior officers in the Malian army, that led to the downfall of the government and the annexation of the north by these Islamist groups. So, you know, retraining and essentially rebuilding the entire Malian army is key to any hopes of stability in the country.
And how big a challenge, how big a job is that?
It's a very big challenge. Mali's army is in a really terrible state. It's divided. We saw just a couple of weeks ago a firefight in the capital Bamako between two branches of the army. We've had reports from towns that were liberated or recaptured by, you know, the French-led military intervention, where the Malian army quickly went in and indulged in reprisal killings, extrajudicial killings of people that they suspected of being Islamists. So they are a disorderly, shambolic group, and it's going to be a steep hill to climb for this European Union training mission to professionalize them.
Do you think this will actually make a difference in Mali?
I think it can do, but it's going to take a long time. I mean, the Germany has, the Bundestag will take a vote on this on Friday, after which the German troops can be deployed, and they have given themselves 12 months of a mandate. The European Union mission, which is beginning now, has a 15-month mandate. But even these kind of timescales, a year, year and a half, really isn't long enough to overhaul an entire national army, and that's what's needed here, a real root and branch form of an army. And that's, you know, as long as European countries are willing to stay with it for the long haul, then I think there's a great deal of hope that things can be changed. But if they are not willing to really commit themselves to the task, then it'll just be a waste of time.
I think you already touched the topic that the military forces in Mali are actually in a terrible state, and it's also about the equipment. How much does it actually help to have German military experts there giving their knowledge, sharing their knowledge at the same time, when what Malian forces really would need is also more equipment?
Yeah, I mean, of course they need sort of hardware support, if you like. And, you know, one part of the role that some of these German troops are going to play will be in kind of logistical support to the French-led military intervention. So that'll be, you know, providing communication support, transport, air refuel, that kind of thing. I mean, Mali's army, it's not short of guns. It's short of professional soldiers. And that's what really needs to be dealt with. And that's why this European Union training mission, of which Germany is going to play quite a key role, is so important.
Thank you very much. That was Monocle's man in Nairobi, Tristan McConnell. Coming up, London has beat out Hong Kong and Rio de Janeiro for the most expensive office space in the world. We'll find out why and whether the price you pay is actually worth what you get.
If we use, dear listeners, the metaphor of Monocle 24 as an online radio amusement park, then Culture with me, Robert Bound, is the roller coaster.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
Scaling the heights of artistic endeavour to look out across a picturesque international landscape dotted with galleries, live music venues, outdoor screenings of wonderful movies being scrutinised and applauded by appreciative audiences. Marvel at the view. Strap yourself in. Scream, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go faster. We're just one metaphor away from a meltdown. On the latest edition, we fight off the paparazzi and lose the entourage to chat with one of Japan's biggest pop stars. Get keen on Kino at the Berlin Film Festival and take a trip to that unlikely art enclave, Tasmania, you devils.
We had a drummer who was submerged in the Derwent and playing underwater for 15 minutes, thrashing away with metal drumsticks on a kit that had hydrofoams on it with a scuba mask on.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Europe's first big election of 2013 takes place next weekend as Italy goes to the polls. And on Monocle 24, we've got it covered. All this week, we'll be reporting from across Italy, getting under the skin of one of the continent's most fascinating countries. Every day on The Globalist and The Monocle Daily, we'll analyse the big issues and the even bigger personalities. That's the Italian election, all this week on Monocle 24.
'14 in London, '14 in Sao Paulo. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. London has topped charts once again, although the majority of Londoners probably aren't too excited to hear that it's about the prices again. According to a new report, London has beat Hong Kong as the city with most expensive office spaces. At the moment, you have to get prepared to pay over €2,100 per square metre or over $260 per square foot in average if you want to have an office in the English capital. It is the first time since 2008 that London took the top spot. Hong Kong is now on the second place on the list, and Rio de Janeiro has jumped to spot number three. I'm now joined on the phone by Joanna Burke, West End news reporter for Estates Gazette. Thank you very much for joining Midori House. First of all, could you tell us, is there any reason for Londoners to be excited about this news?
I think it's exciting in the sense that we are, you know, the West End's retaining the top companies. You know, we've got the big corporates that are all on the hunt for West End offices now. You've got the likes of Apple, Microsoft. It's exciting to know that it's still got a buzz. It's a boost for employment, and it is attracting, you know, great employees.
What exactly does this report tell you about what has happened in London during the last years?
Well, over the last 12 months, we've seen a surge of, you know, tenants saying they want new offices, you know, but the problem is, in the capital, we are undersupplied by quite a large amount, and there are limited amounts of new developments coming out. So basically, you've got all the occupiers fighting for the best space, and therefore pushing up rents, and I don't see this flowing anywhere down at all. I think it's going to continue.
At the same time, the prices are staggeringly expensive in London compared to other major cities. London's office space prices are more than twice those of New York, Paris and Moscow. What explains this?
I mean, I believe, again, I repeat, the you know, huge surge of occupiers. There are quite stringent rules on development, so it's not easy to get, you know, a giant new scheme out the ground. With the sterling pound as well, I think, you know, it's tough. And I do think as well it shows that the top companies in the world are willing to pay for the best postcode. So, you know, Mayfair, we have all the hedge funds fighting for that space. Everyone wants to be on that exclusive postcode. And I think it's showing, you know, we are, while it's hard for occupiers to pay that, people are still willing to do it.
Looking at the ranking list, there are some interesting developments. Yeah. Rio de Janeiro has now jumped to the number 3 spot from number 8. How much different will this ranking list look in a few years of time? What do you think?
Well, I mean, Rio is probably the biggest surprise for all of us. I think they jumped, I think it was about, 43%. And sort of looking at that, they're saying that's, again, because there's a lack of space. And certainly a lack of space for new development. So if that's the case now, maybe, you know, certain places that wouldn't have been so high on the list are going to climb. So Rio is a huge jump. If that's going to continue, you know, there's no space to develop, they could climb the ranks. And, you know, looking at that list, we've got the likes of Tokyo still in there, New York. Again, perhaps they're going to climb the list because they're going to have a shortage of space in the same way that London is experiencing quite badly now. So it's a very interesting list.
So what do you reckon next year, year after, will London still be holding the number one spot?
Right now, I would say this time next year, yes. And that's because of the companies I'm tracking. I know there's big, big companies looking. And I know prices are being forecast up. Right now, you know, there's a few big schemes where hedge funds are going head-to-head, battling it out, price wars, to see who will get that space. So that only says to me we can expect higher. So I'd say London still next year, but, you know, coming years, maybe Rio might climb further again.
Thank you very much, Joanna Burke, Western News reporter for Estates Gazette. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And now it's time to get the latest technology news of the week. Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield spoke to tech expert David Phelan about the Mobile World Congress and the latest from BlackBerry. But they started by talking about the brand new HTC One, which came complete with its own security personal.
I'm very pleased to say David is here.
Hello.
And also we seem to have another guest with us sort of through the glass who isn't going to be talking but is going to be looking at me and making sure I don't do anything wrong. She's waving. Why have we got another guest, David?
That's because I have a phone called the HTC One, which hasn't come out yet.
And am I allowed to touch this?
Yes.
She says yes, good.
And it's a very beautiful phone, I think. It's not out till next month. That's the only phone outside of HTC at this moment.
This one I'm holding?
Yes.
Oh, blimey. No wonder we've got security. So, what's so good about this?
Well, there are a number of things. First of all, it has the highest resolution screen yet on a mobile. That you probably can't count them, but there's 468 pixels per inch there.
You know what? I knew there were at least 300.
Okay.
But 468, I wasn't so sure about. Okay, so that's good.
It has a thing called Blink Feed.
Blink Feed?
I think
okay.
You're looking at the moment.
Go on, you do the Blink Feed thing.
Okay.
I've pressed something. I don't know what to press.
No, that's fine. You're doing fine. It's a series of news feeds and everything else so that you can get to whatever you need on your phone at one touch.
Okay.
That's a new thing. It's an Android phone, but this is something that no other Android phone does. And the other thing is the camera. What's interesting is the other latest phones, like this is the Sony Xperia Z,
okay.
A massive phone,
yeah.
Which has a 13-megapixel camera. Ask me how many pixels there are in the camera on that phone.
David,
yes.
How many pixels are in the camera on that phone?
Well, it's only 4 megapixels.
Four?
Now, so you would think that sounds like it's not very good, but in fact, the pixels are all bigger. On this Sony, they're about 1.1 microns each. They're 2 microns on that, and that means you can get a massive amount more light into each pixel, and that means you get fantastically improved images in low light.
I think I might have just downloaded Shameless. I clicked on TV. It's doing something. Anyway, you can watch that later. It's got TV.
Yeah, yes, it has a number of things that will make use of 4G, the fast data connection that's just about to arrive.
Now, HTC has launched this now. Normally, these sorts of announcements at this time of year would happen in Barcelona at the Mobile World Congress, would they not?
They would, yes, that's right. That's next week. It starts on Monday, and it's where every phone used to be announced. Most companies like Nokia would announce a year's worth of phones at Mobile World Congress each February. That stopped as soon as the iPhone arrived. No one dared announce anything that came out later than June. But now, very little is actually announced there. Samsung have said they're not announcing anything this year. LG has already announced what it's going to announce again next week. And HTC, I suspect, to avoid getting lost in the noise, has announced it now.
Hang on, so why are you going to Barcelona? Is this a jolly then?
No, it is not a jolly. I'll be working very hard. It's to see the smaller companies that don't have the power or the money to have big launches like HTC's one yesterday still get some attention from everyone else.
Okay, well, that makes some sense.
But it's true, it's not the trade show it used to be, although it is moving to a new venue this year, so we'll see if that makes it more relevant.
Let's talk about BlackBerry. Now, since it's brought out its new phones and changed its name from Research in Motion, how's it done? What's your take on how the past 3 weeks have been for them?
I think it's been largely pretty good. This is the new phone, which that's on its lock screen, though you can see my next event is coming here to talk to you.
Oh, yes. So I see.
It's up to date. I think everyone was saying it's make or break for BlackBerry. And when the phone was announced, they were uncertain as to whether this would really work out, but it's done pretty well. I think the early signs are very strong, and devotees of a real physical keyboard on a BlackBerry are going to get their QWERTY phone called the Q10 in about April, they said. And that, I think, will appeal to a lot of the people who don't want an all-touch.
But so far, the touchscreen version is working for you.
Yeah, I think it's great. It's got a very good keyboard that predicts not only letters, but actual words before you get to them. And I think the design is very strong.
Okay, good. And then just quickly, we've just had the 4G auction in the UK. You mentioned 4G earlier. It was, the Treasury had hoped it was going to raise £3.5 billion. In fact, they didn't just hope it. They put it in their figures at the last autumn statement. It didn't. It raised £2.4 billion. Is that actually still not bad?
Yeah, I think it's not bad. And also, it just means that we, as mobile phone users, won't have to pay quite so much because the companies don't have to recoup it back from us.
Well, if we look at what happened with the 3G auction back in 98, 99, I mean, it was about 11 billion. It was massive.
Yeah, the total raised was over 20 billion. And that all came out of your and my phone bills. So.
Yeah.
So, yes, that is the good thing about it.
Okay.
What's also good is that everyone's got a bit. They didn't think everyone would get this desirable 800 megahertz frequency, but all the four operators have it.
Okay. Well, that's something to be pleased with.
Yes.
Briefly, let's just talk about Sony. Are they going to be launching a PS4 today?
Yes, that's the plan. At 11 p.m. UK time, 6 p.m. New York, they're announcing their newest console, and it'll be interesting to see if it can fend off the the erosion of its market share in terms of games from the iPad and other gaming consoles that are in phones and so on.
That was our tech expert David Phelan speaking earlier to our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield. And next we head to Iceland. This is Look at the Light by Sinfang. That was music from Reykjavik, Sinfang with Look at the Light. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Van uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europa, London,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound will join me in this very same studio to talk about the latest German-themed issue of Monocle. And we also find out why Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck always likes a warm reception.
On the counter is a dirty old Dell, on which it tells you to type in a vast list of details from your home address to a contact phone number, in case she wants to phone you for a chat about her miserable job one day, perhaps.
But first, here is Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
Prosecutors have directly challenged two of Oscar Pistorius' claims about the night he shot and killed his girlfriend, Reba Steenkamp. Investigating officer Hilton Boerters told the Pistorius bail hearing in Pretoria a witness saw lights on after the shooting, despite claims the athlete thought there was an intruder in his home and he was too frightened to switch the light on. A statement on behalf of the 26-year-old Paralympian read out in court also said he was not wearing his prosthetic legs at the time and he felt vulnerable. But Mr. Boerter said the trajectory of the shots fired through the bathroom door was downward, suggesting he was firing from a standing position at a height where he must have been wearing the limbs. David Cameron has become the first serving British Prime Minister to pay his respects at the scene of the notorious Amritsar massacre in India. Mr. Cameron, who's on a three-day trade trip to the country, described the massacre in 1919 as a deeply shameful event. Police in Athens have fired tear gas on demonstrators taking part in the latest protest against government austerity measures. Riot police responded after hooded youths threw stones and bottles at them. The country's been brought to a standstill by a 24-hour general strike. Europe's horsemeat scandal has spread to Asia, where an imported lasagna brand has been taken off the shelves in Hong Kong. Food and environmental hygiene officials have ordered Park and Shop, one of the biggest supermarket chains on the island, to remove the product amid fears it may be adulterated with horsemeat that's not been tested for veterinary drugs. Former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. has pleaded guilty to misusing around $750,000 US dollars of campaign money. Mr. Jackson, who's the son of the civil rights leader, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, wept as he entered the plea at court in Washington, D.C. He faces up to 5 years in prison. The Vatican says Pope Benedict may change church rules governing the conclave, the event where cardinals from around the world will meet next month to secretly elect his successor. A spokesman says Benedict is studying the possibility of making changes to two laws established by his predecessor, Pope John Paul, before he abdicates on February the 28th. The changes may affect the timing of the start of the election process. Silvio Berlusconi has infuriated his political rivals by sending letters to millions of Italians promising to reimburse tax they paid in 2012. Mr. Berlusconi has repeatedly promised to repay the tax, but polls show 51% of Italians don't believe him and only 15% find the promise credible. Meanwhile, an Italian anti-corruption party that threatened to divert votes away from Silvio Berlusconi has been thrown into disarray after its leader resigned. Oscar Giannino, the leader of the pro-business Stop the Decline party, has resigned after admitting he'd claimed false academic credentials. Those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
It is 18:32 in London and 13:32 in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And the new German-themed issue of Monocle magazine hits newsstands tomorrow, and obviously our subscribers have the magazines already. And, well, the new magazine's got a German theme, and to celebrate this, we're taking a peek inside the magazine all this week on Midori House, and today I'm joined by Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound.
Good Midori House, cats.
Studio One. Guten Abend. Wie geht's?
Kind of schlecht.
Schlecht.
Kind of schlecht. Uh-huh. I'm all right. All right. So it's nice. This was a nice magazine to put together. This was an easy one to commission, I think, because we have some really good people in Germany. Angela has a lot of stories. Culturally, Marcus, it's quite an easy one for me, I'm pleased to say. And the proof of the pudding's in the reading, right? So it's a good one. We kicked off the culture section with the Haus der Kunst.
I was just going to say that there is loads of everything on the culture section, and yeah, Haus der Kunst, very interesting story.
Loads
in
of
Munich.
Everything. That's what we should put that as another alternative strapline under this big C.
I think
culture section, loads of everything.
I think that's a very good principle to have when you're ever thinking of the lineup for the program.
Exactly.
And the magazine.
And the Haus der Kunst was a wonderful thing to commission because it kind of tells the story of contemporary Germany, in a way, in one building, in a way.
The history of that building is, at the same time, it's fascinating, it's also terrifying, considering, you know, like, why it was built originally.
Exactly. So that's the thing. So it's a really interesting thing. This is a building built in the 30s. It's not an Albert Speer-designed building, but it was one of Hitler's... It was the cornerstone of Hitler's cultural programme. And you know, there are still swastikas which were covered over, and they've cleaned some of the plaster away and left them. So there are still things, and there's this kind of sort of fairly austere typeface that kind of almost deco-ish, but kind of, well, it seems very decadent now, a kind of 30s typeface that the Haus der Kunst is written in on the outside of the building. And essentially it was to propagate these Hitler's myths. And now it holds an amazing array of contemporary art and modern art, and it has all the archives from that time as well, which are really fascinating. So it kind of lives with its history and deals with its history very, very interestingly and creatively.
And in a very interesting way, it also resonates with what's been going on in Germany, considering, for example, in the 1980s, you know, Munich almost demolished the whole building.
Exactly, yeah.
And, you know, this is one of those, you know, very happy cases when actually the building was kept and now it's an amazing arts venue.
Yeah. And it is one of those things. I think it shows a lot of brains and a lot of guts and an interesting relationship with your history to be able to do this. They have a wonderful new director as well, who's a Nigerian-born director who just came from the Documenta Festival, which is the amazing arts festival in Kassel in Germany. So he's kind of come in, and he's very much, you know, he doesn't have any kind of cultural baggage himself, at least German cultural baggage. So it makes it easier to do for him.
You already touched the topic that basically, you know, there is, when you go to the building, you actually see all the historical layers, but how does the museum actually, you know, what do you see there? How does it actually deal with its history?
Well, it does it in terms of, I guess, leaving some of the signage, some of the stuff that was there. I think the very fact that it still exists and that they haven't taken down, as I said, some of the you know, kind of Nazi, not the Nazi memorabilia, but certainly the swastikas that are part of the friezes around some of these grand rooms contain swastikas which they've sort of left. You know, you can't, do you know what I mean? They've just kind of left it. It was a political party which built this thing rather than it being about the lifelong history of Germany. So I think it's one of those things to deal with.
So many, many German stories in the magazine.
Do you want to talk about another German thing?
Let's talk about another. Which other story would you like to pick from?
So that was Kim Bradley wrote that. Thank you very much, Kim. She also wrote this great thing. Munich have two creative directors this year, which is for the first time ever they've decided Munich's almost too clean. So it's this wonderful bourgeois city. It's topped the Monocle quality of life survey at least once over the last 6 years. And it's a city that we all love. Elm Green and Dragset, you might know them. They're artists and curators. One's Norwegian, one's Danish. They have a fantastic studio in an old pumping station in Berlin. They've been employed by the Council of Munich, or whatever, City Council of Munich, to kind of provide a little bit of grit in their oyster to make a beautiful pearl, possibly an artistic pearl. So they're doing a number of weird and wonderful things across the city of Munich this year, which we previewed a couple of those things. I mean, sculptures and interventions and different kind of witty things across the city of Munich this year.
You know, you make it almost sound like that, you know, Tom Edwards, news editor, and some other members of our team should be in Munich instead of Berlin.
Yeah, well,
we're doing the Dory House from Berlin tomorrow. So.
Yeah, right. Well, there's a lot of stuff. For me, culturally, there was a lot of stuff. I mean, I think culturally people think of Berlin. It's the place where, it's a place full of artists, but it's a place where you don't tend to sell art. That's the problem. Whereas Munich, you know, you can't afford a studio, but, you know, people have got a lot of that stuff on their apartment walls.
Genau. Do you have a song for us?
I do, yeah. I've got. We also in the culture briefing section, we interviewed the lead singer of Fenster, who are a really good, successful German band. They're based in Berlin, but they're touring the US right now as we speak. I can't remember the name of the song. Yes, I can. I wrote it down.
I do have it on my papers as well.
I scribbled it down. I forgot about it. It's from their album called Bones, which came out last year. It's a really good record. And this is Killer Surf Walker. It's Fenster.
Soothing sea sounds there. That was Killer Surf Walker by Fenster. Music from Germany. Recommendation by our culture editor Robert Bound. You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be back right after this with a look at a new film from Brazil that has got Brazilians buzzing all about it.
To celebrate the March issue of Monocle with its focus on all that's great about Germany, Monocle 24 is heading to Berlin. On Midori House on Thursday and The Briefing on Friday, we'll be hearing from the artists, gallerists, journalists, architects and designers who are reshaping the nation. We'll be talking everything from the politics of the European Union to the best shopping spots on Augustrasse. Broadcasting live from Pauli-Zahl, join Monocle 24's team in Berlin. Who knows, there might even be some beers and bratwurst along the way. That's Monocle 24, live from Berlin, this Thursday and Friday.
Ever since Monocle launched in 2007, we've championed a roll your sleeves up, put on your overalls attitude to problems and possibilities. The how-to section in our February issue catches up with business owners, innovators and cultural figures creating new ways to work. And the list is an eclectic mix.
A group of frontline do-gooders,
Chilean entrepreneurs going out on a limb for olive oil,
Nashville-based singer-songwriter Caitlin Rose,
ceramic makers injecting life into San Francisco's city centre with a new manufacturing hub.
And we head to the Maldives to meet the entrepreneur who set up a one-man airline.
To learn from the experts how to make, do or mend your business or your ambition, watch our how-to slideshow on monocle.com.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. It is 18:43 in London, 10:43 a.m. in San Francisco. One of the most anticipated films in Latin America is to be released in Brazil next week. Marcelo Galvão's latest film, Colegas, has already won the prize of the best film in the Gramado Festival, which is Brazil's equivalent to Oscars. The film is a Thelma and Louise-inspired road trip film with a Brazilian twist. The three young actors have Down syndrome, and in the film they go on a road trip to chase their dreams. To find out more about this, I spoke to the director of the film himself, Marcelo Galvão.
It's a road movie that shows the simple things in life in a poetic light through the eyes of three kids with Down syndrome. They live in an institution with kids with Down syndrome, and they work at the video library. They love movies. One day, watching Thelma & Louise, they decide to run away to pursue two dreams. The boy wants to fly, the other one wants to go to see the sea, and the girl, she wants to get married. So it's a road movie, it's a comedy.
And what made you want to make a film with a Down syndrome theme?
I grew up with my uncle, he had Down syndrome. For my experience, I remember that was good moments that I had with him. When I decided to write the script, my wish was to make something very close to my uncle, a light movie, a funny movie. It's a film that talks about dreams. It's a light movie. It's not like a drama. I decided to have something very, very close to the experience that I had with my uncle. So it's why I decided to write something, not talking about disabilities, but talking about life, dreams, to have that feeling that I had in my childhood. I decided to have two guys, the main characters, with Down syndrome. So I did a casting and I found the guys.
Would you still say that this is a film with a mission somehow?
You know, when I wrote the script and then when I decided to do the movie, I just want to do something, not like a issue or something. But now I'm seeing that the thing is much bigger than I had imagined. So we had like a video case that we put in the YouTube called Come Champagne from Hollywood, because Ariel, one of the main characters, he dreamed is that Champagne could watch his film. He started to become an actor because the actor. So we did like a very short movie telling about this story, about Ariel. And in 3 days, we had more than 1 million people watching the video, more than 1 million views. Then I think that I realized that this is not just like a normal movie. This is a movie that talks with everybody.
You know, I actually checked the latest numbers from YouTube, how many people had been watching the film this far. It was almost 1.5 million. So obviously there is something that has touched people's hearts. Still, to get back to this theme that people probably talk about and think about, how is Down syndrome perceived in Brazil? Do you think, you know, you are going to make some kind of a change in this with your film?
I think yes, because I had these people that came when they watch the movie, like in festivals that we had. I have like one mother that in the end of the session, she said, you know, in 27 years, I live only for my kid. And he has Down syndrome. But I've never realized, I've never think about what he wants, what his dream. He always lives in my dream. So after watching this movie, I want to know what is his dream. If he wants to fly, if he wants to get married. So when you listen to somebody saying something like that after watching a movie that you made, it's something very powerful. And I had like a lot of different experiences like that. One guy that he had like he just got a baby with Down syndrome, and he was like very, very depressed. So he went to watch the movie, and after the movie, he said, man, I'm very, very proud to have this kid. And so I think that the film is going to change people with kids with Down syndrome and people with normal kids, because the film doesn't talk about disability, talk about dreams, and everybody dreams.
And on the internet, there is still this film where friends of one of the actors of this film, friends of Ariel Goldenberg, are actually pleading for Sean Penn to come to the premiere of this film on March the 1st. Do you think this is going to happen? Do you think Sean Penn is actually going to show up in Brazil?
I think so. I dream with Ariel, and we think that Sean Penn will come. We hope so.
I sure hope so as well, and I can't really believe that Sean Penn could say no when there are over 1 million people asking for that visit on the internet. That was Brazilian director Marcela Galvão in Sao Paulo speaking to me a bit earlier. You are listening to Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Where are you, London? This is Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London, Europe, top.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. And some Monocle people are on their travels as they, well, normally tend to be. And as the brand new edition of the magazine has a German theme, our news editor Tom Edwards is in Berlin getting ready for live radio shows. We will hear the first one tomorrow at around the same time when tomorrow's Midori House is actually broadcast live from Berlin. And, well, Tom has obviously been busy in Berlin getting prepared all that. Am I right, Tom?
Markus, guten Abend. Yeah, it's been a very busy day. We arrived to scenes of
a snowscape here in Berlin, which was pretty dramatic, I must say, as we arrived from the skies. It's been a bit cold, that's the only thing I'd say. The notorious Berlin winter is enduring. But yeah, a busy day. We've met lots of people, and we've checked out our location for tomorrow's recording. I'm very confident we're going to have a terrific show on our hands.
It's a great location, by the way, talking about that first. You are going to be broadcasting live from Pauli Saal, which is quite a new addition to Berlin's restaurant scene. What can you tell us about the building?
Well, yeah, it's really interesting. It's a real sort of landmark of the new objectivity movement from the sort of 20s and into the early 30s in Berlin in particular. It was a Jewish girls' school, and it's been sort of restored into this really intriguing cultural laboratory, as they call it. Culture and gastronomy, Marcus, which will be close to your heart, both very well taken care of. I've already sampled the delights today of the sort of New York-style Jewish deli on the ground floor. I had a delicious soup and a salt beef sandwich just to, you know, in the interest purely, Marcus, I'm sure you understand, of research, not because I was just being greedy. And yeah, we'll be in the bar tomorrow. We've checked out the area. It looks very good, and we've got a great show lined up.
And obviously, Pauli Saal has already been featured on the menu as well. You know, I know my business. So can you tell us about tomorrow's program, Midori House, live from Berlin, starting at 1800 hours London time. What's coming up?
I certainly can, Marcus. Well, yeah, Kimberly Bradley, our illustrious Berlin correspondent, will be joining me. As I work my way through the guests, we'll be speaking to Quentin Peel, who we've been hearing from quite often recently. He's the bureau chief here in Berlin from the Financial Times. He's going to be sharing his insights with us. We've got architect Matthias Sauerbruch joining us. Plenty more besides. We'll be getting a package which our very own Gillian de Bias has put together, amongst other things. And we're going to be out and about in the city tomorrow as well, ensuring we don't miss anything. And the fun doesn't end there, Marcus, because the briefing on Friday, that's also going from Pauli Saal, don't forget, another show, and there's even some, probably even more special guests for that programme.
Well, can you tell us about that?
I certainly can, and wow. I will. We've actually went today, Marcus, to the British Embassy here in Berlin. Quite an impressive building it is too, I must say. It was kind of like entering Fort Knox. Security clearly paramount in their minds, but we, our crack team of producers and myself, went to speak with the ambassador himself, Simon MacDonald, the British ambassador to Germany. Had a really intriguing chat with him. He's a very, very engaging chap, and that's going to be one of the highlights on Friday's briefing. We'll also be talking to Andreas Kluth, who's the bureau chief of The Economist here in Berlin. I'll be reviewing the German papers, something of a briefing staple, but with obviously a German flavour. And we'll be dipping into the history of this city with the architecture expert Jim Hudson. And even maybe, Marcus, another subject close to your heart, talking 90s nightclubs with Simon Schaefer, the former nightclub impresario turned angel investor.
I love how you know what's close to my heart, 90s nightclubs. Have you tasted currywurst already?
I haven't. I must admit, I've been fairly cagey. As I said, I had my soup, which is very nourishing, and I haven't yet ventured out for my evening repast. So I don't know. Perhaps you've got something you should recommend to me. Is there a particular Schnellimbiss that I should be visiting?
Oh, I think there are plenty. I'm going to send you an email in a second. By the way, what's the thing about weather? It's only -5 degrees over there, Tom.
Yeah, but Marcus, you know what I'm like. I'm quite brittle. I'm quite thin. I don't have that nice reassuring covering that some of my unmentioned colleagues at Midori House have. So you know, the winter weather chills me to my bones.
Well, I hope you survive until tomorrow.
I'll hang in there. Don't you worry about me.
Midori House as 1800 hours tomorrow, hosted by Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards in Berlin. And now it's time for our daily monologue. Today we turn to Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck, who thinks that the brand experience begins as soon as you walk into reception.
If you want to know what a company thinks of its customers, its partners, the outside world, take a look at their reception. That's if they actually have one. Just as first impressions count for people, so they do for businesses, whatever their size or sector. But judging by some of the lobbies I've found myself in over the past few months, there are a lot of enterprises that may have glossy, smiling faces on their billboard campaigns, but which back at HQ are revealed as scruffy, unthinking, and pretty useless. Scene 1. a lobby at the HQ of a major company involved in hospitality. You arrive on the 20th floor, but while there is a reception, there is no receptionist, and all doors in every direction are sealed and frosted. Then, on the reception, you spot a phone and a sheet of instructions. Your task is to key in the name of the person you are meeting and then dial their extension. Fine, except the person you are meeting is not on the list. At that point, the receptionist returns from her lunchtime run, dripping in sweat. But before you can say hello, she's darted through the frosted door and will not be seen again. Finally, by dialing random numbers, you find a live person who agrees, reluctantly, to search out the person you are meeting. You do not wish these people well. Scene 2. The reception for a leading global brand, where you're due to meet the CEO. This time, there is a receptionist, but she's not there to work. You are, honey. On the counter is a dirty old Dell, on which she tells you to type in a vast list of details from your home address to a contact phone number, in case she wants to phone you for a chat about her miserable job one day, perhaps. You're with two colleagues and have to do the same for them, too. Meanwhile, she stands there with nothing to do and not a smile on the horizon. No wonder they're a struggling business these days. Scene 3. A sunny day in California. Now here the reception bit works a treat, and the receptionist is a camp older woman who would be as at home in a diner as she is in this sparkling office. You go to the meeting room and you wait. And you wait. You've flown several thousand miles, but the journey from nearby desks to this soulless bunker seems trickier for the locals. But then the best bit. They all arrive carrying giant, teat-topped water bottles that they then proceed to suck on throughout the next 40 minutes. It's a good meeting, but as they purse their lips to nipple, do they never wonder if visitors to this tower should at least be offered a glass of water? Luckily, there are companies that do get it right, and it's funny how it's those businesses you usually end up wanting to work with. You can be half sold on a deal if you find yourself happy and content to sit and wait in their lobby. Here are a few tips from the more successful of welcomers. 1. Have a nice space to wait with magazines, a guest Wi-Fi setup, and make sure the receptionist actually knows the code. 2. Offer people water, good coffee. 3. Make sure you've booked a meeting room and not one that was used for drinks the night before and still smells of beer. Have business cards at the ready. Oh, and have a receptionist who likes their job and realises they're the first experience that any visitor will have of your brand. And finally, get rid of that old Dell. For Monocle, I'm Andrew Tuck.
And that is all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer Hannah Jenkins, our researchers Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Annabel Bly, and our studio manager Chris Fitch. Next up is a special edition of The Entrepreneurs focusing on wellness. On the show we'll be hearing from Kate Percival in London's Belgravia, who has opened up a spa that doubles up as a female's only club for the modern, hardworking woman.
We're doing exactly what we set out to do, which was to support women to be the best that they possibly can be in whichever area they choose that to be, whether it's picking the kids up from school or being chairman of the board.
In 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Louise Beale will be back for the Monocle Daily. And tomorrow we will be back with a very special Midori House live from Berlin. Don't miss that. I am Markus Hippi. Thank you for listening and goodbye.